As we begin, I have a question that may seem strange at first. The question is, what or who do you worship? What do you worship? I'm not asking what or who do you sing songs about. I'm asking, what do you truly worship? To understand the question better, I think you have to think of it outside of the context of church and worship services. Everyone worships. The question is, what do you worship? The word worship, other than in the context of church or maybe love songs, is a word that we do not often use. Maybe if I remind you of what worship means, it will help you think of what I'm saying when I say everyone worships. In English dictionaries, worship speaks of a reverential awe. It's an awe of something or someone, and consequently, because you live in awe of that something or someone, you in fact give complete devotion to that something or someone. You're so captured by it, you give yourself to it. You order your life around it, because in awe of it, you are in complete devotion to it. In the Hebrew language and in the biblical text that we're going to look at today, the word worship speaks of fear and service. If you think about it for just a moment, you realize it's the same two concepts that we've already seen in English. That fear in worship is about a reverential awe, or even stronger, it's an unsettling terror at being in the presence of something so different, so big, so encompassing, that you can't comprehend it. So much bigger than you are, and having the ability to exercise control over you so that you are in awe or terror or fear. But worship is not only about fear or that reverential awe, it's also about serving. True worship of anything results in serving that which we worship. It seems that when we fear something, and I'm not talking now about simply being frightened or afraid, I'm talking again about that fear which is that reverential awe. When we fear something or someone, there's a certain self-preservation that either tries to control that or else yield to it. When something truly threatening confronts us, our first tendency is to run away from it. Our second tendency is to determine what we must do in order to mitigate the threat against us. How can we possibly control this presence in which we feel so little, so much like nothing? In other words, we serve what we think will best serve us. That's the relationship most people have with their gods. The tribal peoples of the world called animists are those who fear gods of rocks and trees. They believe that the gods of rocks and trees have control over their lives, and so the animists work very hard at appeasing those gods, serving those gods, so that those gods will in turn favor them with protection, health, pleasure, and long life. The modern secularists don't fear gods of rocks and trees, they fear the unknown. They fear fate. And so they diligently serve the gods of money and power, desperately hoping that they will at least delay the unknown, give at least temporary protection, health, pleasure, and long life. So whether it's the animists or the secularists or countless other variations, people give themselves to, that is, they serve the gods that they think best will protect them and provide for them. Some others may give lip service to religion, to a specific religion, but they worship, that is, they fear and they serve the gods of money or power or prestige. When you think about it, how else can you ever explain a man or a woman selling themselves to their job at the cost of their family, their friends, or everything else? They fear life. They fear life without the security and significance that money can buy, and thus they serve the gods of money and position. They may not think of it that way, but in order to secure their lives in some way, they look for what they will serve that they think will bring that security. They worship and serve those gods. We can tell who it is or what it is we worship by looking at what it is we most fear, and consequently, what it is we serve. Maybe our thinking is not as sophisticated as that. Maybe it comes down to something like Joy Davidson speaks of in her book, Smoke on the Mountain. She said, "What shape is an idol? I worship Ganesha, god of worldly wisdom, patron of shopkeepers. He is in the shape of a little fat man with an elephant's head. He's made of soapstone and has two small rubies for eyes. What shape do you worship? I worship an Audi convertible. All of my days I give it offerings of washings and polish. Hours of my time are devoted to its ritual, and it brings me good luck as it establishes me among my fellows as a success in life. What model's your car, brother? I worship my house beautiful. Long and loving meditations are spent on it. The chairs contrast with the rug. The curtains harmonize with the woodwork. All of it is in perfect and holy harmony. I live for my home, and it rewards me with the envy of my sisters. Lest my children profane the holiness of my house with dirt and noise, I drive them out of doors. What shape is your idol, sister? I worship my job. I worship my golf game. I worship my comfort. After all, isn't enjoyment the goal of life? What shape is your idol? What do you serve? Even behind the service, what do you fear? What do you fear, and how is it that you are attempting to control your life? What do you worship? The revered leader and now old man Joshua has called the nation, the people of Israel, together to hear his final words, and apparently he has moved down to the city of Shechem, where he's going to give the final words. The final words after chapter 23. In the midst of these final words before his death, he really summarizes it with these words, verses 14 and 15 of chapter 24. Now fear the Lord. Serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Remember, I began with asking, what or who do you truly worship? I think that's the same question Joshua is here asking. And Joshua makes it clear later, as I have already, that worship is not just about sitting in worship services and singing songs. Worship is about what or who you fear, and what or who you serve. And Joshua suggests to the people of Israel that they have before them at least three options of who they will serve. You can worship the gods of your forefathers, the ones they worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt. Or you can worship the gods of the Amorites, or you can worship the Lord God. Now, it's very evident to me from the context, Joshua is not suggesting that these are equally valid options. He's simply acknowledging, as we must, that there are other gods. That is, there are other gods that vie for our attention. Not that they are living gods, but there are other gods of this world who would call for our worship. That is, for our fear and our service. I know a man that, though reared in a very different religion, for several years heard the gospel preached, and in fact finally responded, claiming that he trusted in Jesus Christ alone as saving Lord and would serve God. Not very many years after that, and then for many years subsequently, he never darkened the door again of a church and lived instead serving other gods. Very recently, that man has learned that he is very soon going to die. And he has returned now to all of the accoutrements of his childhood religion. And he is very actively placing his hope in very specific recitations of certain prayers. He trusts more in the ancient gods from beyond the river, if I may put it that way, than he does in the living God. Some people who stood before Joshua that day were in fact placing their hope, their confidence, if you will, in those gods that their forefathers had worshipped. Others who were standing before him that day were placing their hope, their confidence, they had fear and awe, and they were serving the gods of the Amorites. The Amorites were those who lived among the Israelites in the land. Attracted to those gods, some of the Israelites were worshiping those contemporary gods, the culturally accepted gods. The options were real. There were other gods to choose from. But Joshua is appealing to his people in these his final words, to choose the Lord. Now it's true that in this text, he will warn them. What happens if they do not choose the living God? But that is not the emphasis of this text, even though it was, I believe, of chapter 23. In this text, he emphasizes the overwhelming superiority of their God. And the emphasis is on the grace of God. When he finishes, he would say to them, knowing what you know about your God, how could you possibly turn to any other God? Joshua chapter 24, beginning at verse 2, listen to him, please, as he appeals to these people, as God does to us today. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago, your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham and Nahor, lived beyond the river, that is, beyond the Euphrates in present-day Iraq, and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from that land and led him throughout Canaan and gave him many descendants. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. I assigned the hill country of Seir to Esau, but Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt. Then I sent Moses and Aaron, and I afflicted the Egyptians by what I did there. And I brought you out. When I brought your fathers out of Egypt, you came to the sea, and the Egyptians pursued them with chariots and horsemen as far as the Red Sea. But they cried to the Lord for help, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians. He brought the sea over them and covered them. You saw with your own eyes what I did to the Egyptians. Then you lived in the desert for a long time. Before going on in your reading, stop for a moment and notice what Joshua is doing. There are many, many things that Joshua could talk about in terms of the history of the people of Israel. But what do you see him camping on? You see him camping on those times that God so miraculously intervened in their lives that they ought not to ever lose sight of God's grace to them. He quickly passes over their sins, their faithlessness. For example, he takes 40 years of recent history and sums it up with these words, "Then you lived in the desert for a long time." It's not his intention to talk about their failures. It's his intention to talk about God's faithfulness. I read on. I brought you to the land of the Amorites who lived east of the Jordan. They fought against you, but I gave them into your hands. I destroyed them from before you, and you took possession of their land. When Balak, son of Zippor, the king of Moab, prepared to fight against Israel, he sent for Balaam, son of Beor, to put a curse on you. But I would not listen to Balaam. So he blessed you again and again, and I delivered you out of his hand. Then you crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho. The citizens of Jericho fought against you, as also did the Amorites, the Perizzites, Canaanites, Hittites, Girgashites, Hivites, and Jebusites. But I gave them into your hands. I sent the hornet ahead of you, which drove them out before you, also the two Amorite kings. You did not do it with your own sword and bow. So I gave you a land on which you did not toil and cities you did not build, and you live in them and eat from vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. Earlier I said that worship is about fear and service. Most religion and most of life is about trying to overcome what we fear. It is our attempt at placating the gods. Our attempt at somehow manipulating the system to get what we are convinced we need, protection and pleasure or prominence. Whether it's this religion or that religion, it's trying to figure out exactly what are you supposed to do in that religion. How can you appease God? How can you act in such a way that he will indeed do for you what you can't do for yourself? How can you make sure that you can properly devote yourself to Him so that He will protect you and provide for you. And so whether as a religionist or a secularist, we work hard to serve the God that we think will yield the most. But what if you learned that there's a God who is not only to be feared and served, but what if you learned that there is a God who loves you and is not looking to you to earn His favor? What if you learned that there's a God who instead simply wants you to respond to His favor? What if you learned that He went ahead of you, made the way for you, He's protecting you, providing for you, and all of it simply because He loves you? Joshua reminds them that just as with them, so with Abraham, God didn't choose Abraham because Abraham was worth choosing. God chose Abraham because of God's choice to be gracious to him. One man writes this: there's a persistent tendency in the popular Christian mind to look upon folks like Abraham as if they had always been good, solid, helpful folks to whom no God who had an ounce of wisdom could avoid taking a shine. But Abraham is as guilty as the rest for his worship of other gods. All of which goes to show that John Newton was right. Grace really is amazing. So amazing that we can't believe it. So we go on concocting our graven images of biblical all-stars like Abraham, picturing them as worthy fellows already disposed toward God, already on their way to truth, needing only a little help from God to finish the conversion so nobly begun. But Calvin wisely reminds us, Abraham did not emerge from profound ignorance and the abyss of error by his own virtue, but he was drawn out by the hand of God. I think Joshua is attempting to remind the people that there's not a one of them who deserves the grace of God. Everything they have, and the very coming to God itself has been by the grace of God. They were sought out by God. They didn't seek Him. If you were reared in a Christian home, or you were roommated with a Christian who witnessed to you, then it ought to make you very humble and grateful. Humble and grateful to realize that God is the one who sought you out. We were not seeking Him. He came and He found us. He loves us and loves you. I haven't time to note each of the historical incidences that Joshua notes in this 24th chapter, but I want to mention just a couple more of them so you can see clearly what he's doing as he's reminding these people of God's grace. In verses 5 to 7, he speaks of when they escaped from Egypt and they were cornered by the Egyptians in the face of that impassable Red Sea. Joshua says, "You cried to the Lord for help, and He did the miraculous, which you saw with your own eyes." Verses 8 to 10, he reminds them of God's unseen protection of them, when unbeknownst to them, God was manipulating a prophet so that that prophet was not able to curse them, but he blessed them instead, in contrast to what his boss wanted. Verses 11 to 13, Joshua reminds them of the victories that they had just recently seen, again, seen with their own eyes. Reminds them the land on which they lived, the cities in which they lived, the fields that they tended were theirs not by their strength or by their wisdom, but by God's grace. Author Dale Davis summarizes God's love for Israel, and I think for us, with these words: "Remember," God speaking, "how I took you as my own, how I rescued you in your helplessness, how I shielded you from dangers seen and unseen, how I sustained you with bread and meat until this very day." Or as the hymn writer put it, "Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be." The Apostle Peter said it this way in 1 Peter 1, "For you know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from your empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect." Yes, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the Lord of the universe, is a fearful God, but He is the God who loves us and has called us to Himself. And so Joshua says, understanding that grace of God, now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord. Joshua, I believe, stood before those people calling for a decision. There was a choice to be made. Which God will you serve? I'd like you to hear a testimony. Dick, would you come, please? I'd like you to hear one man's experience of that choice. Which God will you serve?
Used to even discuss it. Her best-known books were The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, although her book We the Living is the one that hooked me. Interestingly enough, even though she has been dead since 1982, her books are enjoying a renewed popularity today. God for the Objectivist was individualism. They worshiped competence. They believed in capitalism without conscience. Contradictions did not exist in their world. Selfishness was seen as a virtue. Humility was viewed as a sign of weakness. Rand and her philosophy had no need for God. Early in the 60s, as a college student and later as a young professional, her philosophy had great appeal for me. It was logical, it was rational, and it fed my ego. As a person, I was proud and arrogant. I was self-reliant and self-centered. As the Simon and Garfunkel song of that era said, I was a rock, I was an island, I needed no one. If you had known me then, I don't think you would have liked me. I grew up as a special event church attender, you know, Christmas, Easter, weddings, funerals. I had very little understanding and no commitment to spiritual things. Objectivism was a good fit for me. I wish someone had told me, if you don't stand for something, you will fall for anything. For the moment, it seemed like objectivism was working. Though I believe the philosophy and though all of my objectivist friends claimed to be atheists, I could never bring myself to say there is no God. And though my life seemed to be going okay, deep down, there was a void. There was an empty place in my life. And I see now, I always believed in God. I had just never taken the time to consider what that really meant for me personally. Then, at age 26, a funny thing happened. As Pastor Nelson pointed out in a message last fall, someone was fighting for my soul. My sister and my brother-in-law had recently become Christians, and they were praying for me, as were people in their church. And God was making his move. A job change in December of 1968 required a move from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Denver. I left my family, all my friends, and nearly everyone I knew. And I came to a place where I didn't know anybody, not one person. It was the Christmas season. I was all alone, and God had me right where he wanted me. Through a set of God-directed circumstances, I found myself in an evangelical church, listening to the gospel. And the hound of heaven, as Francis Thompson called him, had caught up with me. And I heard the challenge: choose this day whom you will serve. Either the hollow, empty, impotent gods of Rand's philosophy, or the living, powerful, loving God of the Bible. I had seen enough of the selfish, cold, egotistical, objective lifestyle. I had seen the feet of clay of its founder. And I chose. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That was 34 years ago. And I'm telling you this morning, that was the best choice I have ever made.
The people indicate that they respond. Look at it, please, in verse 16. Far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. It was the Lord our God himself who brought us and our fathers up out of Egypt from the land of slavery and performed those great signs before our eyes. He protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And the Lord drove out before us all the nations, including the Amorites who lived in the land. We too will serve the Lord because he's our God. That sounds like a choice to me. That sounds like the kind of affirmation of faith that I would love to hear from somebody who claims they're going to be a Christ follower. But what does Joshua say to their faith, to their statement? Verse 19, you are not able to serve the Lord. He's a holy God. He's a jealous God. He will not forgive your rebellion and your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, he will turn and bring disaster on you and make an end of you after he's been good to you. What does Joshua mean? What could he possibly mean when he says you're not able to serve the Lord? He means there should be no cheap conversion, no cheap commitment. Don't say so readily, oh, I'll serve God, when all it really means is an hour on Sunday morning and then 167 hours worshiping, that is, fearing and serving the other gods. One author, I think, captures it well with these words: don't lightly mouth your profession of faith, Joshua is saying. Don't you realize the sort of God you're dealing with? He is a holy, jealous God. You don't dare come to him thinking, though it makes him sad to see the way we live, he'll always say, I forgive you. Yahweh is not a soft, cuddly Santa in the sky who drools over easy decisions during invitation hymns. Joshua seeks to put down that blathering self-confidence that makes emotional commitments rather than shutting its mouth and counting the cost. Serving the Lord is not a matter of adding God to our to-do list. You cannot have two masters. True worship is about fearing and serving the living God of the universe. Jesus said in Matthew 6, no one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will just be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon. Someone well wrote, worship is an expression of total dependence, and obedience is the fundamental expression of that total dependence. Derek, would you come, please? I'd like Derek to also share a testimony, again, of the choice of serving the living God.
I've been a part of Gables now for about a year. As a child, I was raised in a very doctrinally sound evangelical church with a mother who loved God and served him wholeheartedly, and a father who opposed her on occasion. Those occasions led to infrequent but nonetheless painful trials throughout my childhood. My relationship with Christ was still strong and growing as I entered into adolescence, but things began to go wrong because of anger that I had allowed to build up. And as I grew into a teenager, so did the anger and rebellion. And it wasn't long before it nearly controlled almost every single area of my life. I didn't realize it as it was happening, but I had allowed my own pain and the anger to pretty much replace the God of my childhood and set up a new God, and that was myself. I no longer sought to serve Christ. I was rather serving myself and anything that would bring satisfaction or pleasure, even if it was only just temporary. This pattern continued well into my mid-20s. And I had pursued music as a career and also a way of life. To me, a music industry was completely comprised of self-serving, self-seeking God-makers. I was out for myself, and any fame or fortune that I received, I thought was a result of something that I had done. This set me up to become the God of my own world. It's a very, very easy trap to fall into, especially if you have any type of musical talent or gift at all. That the catch comes when you find out how quickly this godhood leaves you as soon as the show is over or as soon as you've walked off the stage. The downside of this is completely and totally devastating. So you turn to alternate means of filling the void. And soon enough, I had found that I had created countless means of escaping a painful truth. Self-serving friendships, preoccupying sports, hobbies, self-medicating, and finally, complete and total denial. Vicious cycle doesn't end until it destroys you. Problem came that when I found out to end this cycle, I had to renounce my godhood. I had to let go of the supremacy that I carried in my own world. It was a feat that I couldn't manage on my own. And so the cycle just continued. Approximately a year and a half ago, I was called to go on a short Midwest tour. I was working as a AV tech for a company that I worked with at that time. I pulled into Kansas City, into a parking lot at a hotel, and saw a tour bus with a sign on it that said, Young Life. I knew what I was in for. this was going to be a boring, straight-laced, Bible reading, praise God kind of week. Well, I needed the money bad enough that grabbed my bags and climbed on board. I mean, do these people even know what quality production is like? What could I possibly learn from this crew? Little did I know what I was in store for. I saw people truly passionate about life. They were excited about the message that they were sharing, and they were confident in what they were delivering to the audience. About halfway through this tour, I was asked to operate spotlights for a drama team. This drama team had been delivering a presentation that week that lives with me to this day. It was at that point, during that presentation, with tear-filled eyes, that I became aware of what had to be done. Revolution in my life was necessary now. Not tomorrow, not next week, not next month, but right then and there. As I began to allow God to soften my heart and break me right where I stood, it was totally evident to me that what the drama team had been saying all week long was true. He is the king, and I'm not. Choice was made again in my life of who to serve. Now, you might think that the story ends right there and everything's all happy-go-lucky for me now, but you can't be further from the truth. That decision completely altered the course of my life. Completely. Friendships had to change. My business decisions had to change. Hobbies had to change. And all my passions needed to change. All of which I handled in 1 week right after the tour. Seriously, the process of change in my life, I believe it's just begun. But I still struggle with these things every single day. With God's grace, He's bringing about those changes because I am too weak, personally, to bring those changes about myself. Though all of the pain and trials that this process has rendered, God has been faithful, loyal, forgiving, and gracious. It allows me to say to you, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord.
You've heard Dick. You've heard Derek. Most of all, you hear from Joshua. Choose for yourself this day whom you will serve. Again, I ask you, who do you worship? Stand with me, please, in prayer. The Spirit of God, work in our hearts. There are probably several, maybe many of us, who have for years claimed that you are our God, that we worship you. But the truth of the matter is we fear and serve other gods. Forgive us, Father, and draw us back to know you. You are the God of the universe. You are the one who loves us. That we would worship you. Father, I pray for those in this place today who are like Dick and Derek were before being confronted with that choice. God, please help him or her, even in this moment, by your grace, to make that choice, to serve you and you alone, to trust you, to worship you, God. We ask this in the name of Christ. Amen. If you're in need of making that choice, please, there are folks available in the prayer chapel off to your left. Don't leave here without doing it. God bless you.